to be young, undocumented, and black today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Living in immigration limbo in the U.S. is tough enough. It can be even harder if you're undocumented and black.
As a black undocumented immigrant, so already the rest of the world doesn't want you. And then it's like, there's that feeling of, well, I don't belong here.
And after World War II, English families agreed to host German kids as part of a peace effort.
So I was on the phone straight away and says, my mum says I can have a German child.
70 years later, June and Gretel are still friends. Plus, our correspondent runs into one heck of a story in Saudi Arabia.
It's a camel cultural festival, kind of a heritage festival. There's a camel beauty contest. There are kind of competitions.
All that's ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It is Friday, and the world for Washington this week has been Republicans versus Democrats, Republicans versus Republicans, a president constantly shifting positions on key issues. It's been chaos, really, all as the country stared down another drop-dead budget deadline. One of the things at stake with that deadline is the future of nearly 700,000 undocumented immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children. They've been temporarily protected from deportation and given easier access to education under the program known as DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. The program was started by President Obama, but President Trump has tried to kill it, and that's triggered big worries among DACA families and others. It's a conversation that has gripped the whole country. Here's one family that brought their worries this week to the ABC morning chat show, The View. The father has been deported, and his kids are concerned about their future.
How are you feeling?
Sad, angry.
Tears on national TV. That's where we're at in the battle over DACA. We've been hearing from other young immigrants this week in our series DACA Diaries. Today, the story of a student who is originally from Zambia. She's been navigating all of this uncertainty while trying to find her own way within the immigrant rights movement. Here's The World's Kenya Downs.
I meet Wemwa near her home in Maryland. We jump on the metro for D.C. ahead of a busy day. Work, errands, and then she's hosting an event tonight, up in front of people, public speaking, something she would have definitely avoided before she got DACA status. Now she's out in front, talking about being an immigrant and how DACA has changed her life.
I had all these dreams of, like, I'm going to be a pediatric cardiologist, I'm going to do all of this. I had a huge dream that I was going to live in Alaska. Like, we came here for better opportunities. Do I still just push through?
Wemwa says Alaska appealed to her because it was far, yet still in the U.S. Plus, she wanted a Husky. In the end, Wemwa stayed in Maryland. DACA helped her afford college, and she's hoping to get an advanced degree in community health, though it feels uncertain with the Trump administration trying to end DACA. But she does know this. DACA has made her more passionate to talk about black immigrants, a demographic she says some immigrant advocacy circles ignore.
As a black undocumented immigrant, so already the rest of the world doesn't want you. And then it's like, there's that feeling of, well, I don't belong here.
Wemwa came to the U.S. with her mom from Zambia when she was 4. Wemwa asked that we not include her last name because of her status. Her family arrived legally on visitor's visas. Then they saw opportunities here and tried for other visas. Nothing worked. So they joined some 600,000 other undocumented black immigrants in the U.S. Wemwa received her DACA status when she was 17. She's 21 now and says it was a privilege to start adulthood free of the uncertainty other undocumented immigrants face.
It allowed me to just transition the same way everybody else was transitioning.
But she's also aware that black immigrants, primarily from Africa and the Caribbean, only make up 5% of undocumented people in the U.S., but they are detained and deported at higher rates. Today, Wemwa runs the Washington, D.C. chapter of UndocuBlack, a national network for undocumented black immigrants. Tonight, the group is hosting a forum to talk about DACA. Wemwa also says it's a chance to share black perspectives, which she says can feel erased from bigger immigration debates and at street protests, too. The call-outs are often in Spanish.
Every chant is in Spanish. No, there's no inclusion there. And it's like, if we speak up, it's like, well, why would you expect any different, right? Or where you walk into a space that is supposed to be for immigrants and you're like one of five black people.
From Wemla, groups like UndocuBlack also bridge Black immigrants and African Americans.
So it's creating that space for people who just identify as being Black, right? Where it's like we're not necessarily discriminatory, but to be like, yeah, I can own my Blackness and be as beautiful in it as possible and not feel like I'm alone in it as well.
Back on the subway, Wemla says the commute lets her think about her future. Her mind is racing about that now with this political storm over DACA.
I don't want to think about it because then if I think on it too much, it'd be like, that would be like, oh my God, what's next? But then it's like, should I even be worried? The other people have survived. Yeah, it's a lot of like back and forth.
When she gets home, she says she'll bury herself in a book, James Baldwin's Nobody Knows My Name. She relates to its theme, the struggle with identity. She says she never fully feels Zambian or American and questions the need to identify herself at all. And that's her advice for other people in her situation now. Relax, if you can. She says, you're more than DACA. You're more than undocumented. For The World, Kenya Downs, Washington, D.C.
So what do you think about this question? What should our policy be for young undocumented immigrants who've lived most of their lives in the U.S.? Join the conversation at the PRI Facebook page or look for the hashtag DACA Diaries. Now, DACA is not the only immigration program under attack. Temporary Protected Status, or TPS, has also been dropped for people from a number of countries, including El Salvador. More than 200,000 Salvadorans have lived in the U.S. since a series of earthquakes hit their country back in 2001. But the government now says it's ending TPS for Salvadorans. Amparo Marroquin Parducci studies immigration at the University of Central America in San Salvador. She says for the Salvadorans returning, they will face economic difficulties.
It's really hard to get work here in El Salvador. Our economy depends on remittances, so it's not good for the Salvadorian economy to have the people here back. But I think maybe it's good for the Salvadorian society because we have new skills back to this country, the new skill that Salvadorian bilingual populations can give us.
So I read that the number of people returning, if it is the full number, would be over 200,000. That accounts for about 4% of El Salvador's population. Can El Salvador absorb so many people at once?
I think it would be difficult. And I think the government and Salvadoran society is not prepared for that. And I think a lot of TPS Salvadoran are not thinking to return to El Salvador. I heard that some of them are thinking, for example, to go to Canada and to try new opportunities in another countries, taking advantage that they are English spoken, that they have this education. So they are thinking in Canada, they are thinking in Australia. We have a lot of population in those countries.
And are you also hearing about some of the TPS beneficiaries just staying here in the U.S. under the radar?
Yes, they are going to take this risk and they are going to be in the United States without the documents, without the papers. They maybe lose their jobs, but they think it's better that than return to our country, to El Salvador.
Right. Well, one of the big reasons for that is deep concerns about kids especially getting pulled into the orbit of gang violence in El Salvador. Can you just tell us how real that possibility is?
Well, it's a real possibility now, one of the more violent countries. And we have, I think, the same statistical murders than we have when we have civil war here in the 80s.
So, Amparo, you're in El Salvador where you study immigration, but I'm guessing when you heard this Trump announcement about the end of TPS, your reaction was not so academic and probably more personal.
Yes, I have family in the United States. I have family in Canada. I have family in Australia, too. So I was really hopeless. But I always think that when we are hopeless, we need to find hope. We need to find the voices of hope. We have 18 months to look in the Congress what we can do for a new law. I think the announcement is really heartbreaking, but I think that it's a time to try to understand how to continue to defend the rights of the migrants.
Amparo Marroquin studies immigration at the University of Central America in San Salvador. Thank you very much for your thoughts and your time today.
Thank you very much to you.
Now, one of the reasons you listen to The World is to see how these big debates like immigration play out in other countries. So let's take a look at what's going on in Israel right now. Tens of thousands of asylum seekers have been entering Israel from Africa, mostly from Eritrea and Sudan. And the Israeli government has sent many of them to a harsh camp in the desert. One former official says the goal was to make their lives so miserable that they give up and let the government deport them. Now Israel is taking an even tougher stance, is telling the refugees that they have 90 days to accept $3,500 in cash and a one-way ticket home or to an unnamed third country in Africa, or they can go to jail. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said an influx of African migrants threatens Israel's social fabric and the Jewish nature of the state. But one group of rabbis disagrees. They've launched a campaign called the Anne Frank Home Sanctuary Movement, and they've pledged to hide the migrants in their homes to protect them from deportation. The movement's leader is Rabbi Susan Silverman. You may know her sister, the comedian Sarah Silverman. So the position of the government of Benjamin Netanyahu is pretty clear. It sounds like he wants to protect kind of the Jewish character of Israel. How worried are you about opposing the government's position, even going to jail? I mean, you've got a family and children after all.
Yeah, I mean, that obviously concerns me, but there is no question here. We have a situation where the government is saying that either people are going to be deported or they're going to be put into prison indefinitely. You know, I came to live in Israel because I feel that the Jewish people have something to offer. And that offer, what we have to offer, is a moral vision. And if we're not going to live up to our values, then there's no reason to have a Jewish state.
What has been the reaction in Israel to your activism against the deportations?
It's amazing. We just announced this week, and I cannot tell you how many emails and phone calls people from all over the country are writing, from all walks of life. I mean, one of the most moving emails we got was from someone, a single mom lives in South Tel Aviv, and she said, I live in a two-bedroom apartment. I can take 10 asylum seekers. Sign me up. It's just been an overwhelming response, and I'm really heartened.
So you've called this the Anne Frank Home Sanctuary Movement, and I have to think that's partly why it's getting a lot of media attention from all across the world. But is that really an accurate parallel?
Yeah, so I'm not saying that the situation of asylum seekers in Israel is comparable at all to Anne Frank's situation. It's not. Mm. What is comparable is that if they're not able to stay here, then they will be subject to great, great, great risk. And so we need to protect them from being sent out of Israel, where they are safe, to countries where they will not be safe. And so that's a parallel there. But really, the Anne Frank movement, the reason that I started calling it that is based on an Eritrean refugee who came to Israel. When he left Eritrea, he was in an Ethiopian refugee camp where in the library he read the Diary of Anne Frank. He had never heard of her before. Mm. He was so moved. He translated the entire book into Tigrinya. And then he left the refugee camp and headed for Israel. And the whole way, as he was heading for Israel through a harrowing, harrowing trip, he said to himself, the people of Anne Frank will protect me. And so that's why we're using the name Anne Frank when we talk about this effort, because it is the people of Anne Frank who should protect him and the other refugees who are among us.
So that woman you mentioned earlier, he said, I'll take 10 people into my little apartment. Like, how far would she be willing to go to shelter them?
So that I don't know.
How far would you be willing to go? Would you get arrested?
Oh, yeah. What choice do we have? I don't see any choice here. And, you know, I was raised by my dad taught Holocaust studies. And he always said, if you want to know what you would have been doing in Germany, ask yourself what you're doing for people at risk in the world today.
Rabbi Susan Silverman of Israel's Anne Frank Home Sanctuary Movement, which is sheltering African asylum seekers in Israel. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Remember Europe before Brexit? You know, Brexit, Britain's ongoing efforts to leave the European Union. It's been dominating much of the news from across the Atlantic these days. And that's why we were struck by this next story. It's by my BBC colleague, Chris Browning. And it takes us back to Britain 70 years ago, post-World War II. Browning recently met two women, June Whitcomb of Reading, England, and Gretel Reber of Düsseldorf, Germany. This is a story of how the two forged a lifelong friendship.
lieben ohne Liebe kannst du nicht.
I hadn't met any German people, and when I first saw Gretel, I was quite disappointed because she looked quite normal. I thought she'd probably have at least, you know, horns and maybe two heads.
She has repeated that so often that I will never forget that sentence.
That's June and Gretel, and they grew up at war. For 4 years in the 1940s, planes took off from the airfield near June's house in Reading in the south of England and dropped bombs on Gretel's city of Dusseldorf in northwest Germany. This was the soundtrack to Gretel's childhood. In October 1944 alone, the sirens rang out 112 times.
The centre of the city was in ruins. When I heard the thunder of a bomb that fell, I was happy because it hadn't hit us. Because as long as you hear it, it's been somewhere else.
By the end of the war in 1945, 96% of the city's buildings had been damaged. A public health report on Dusseldorf in the years after the war showed 1 in 3 children were malnourished. A British Army soldier who'd been stationed in Dusseldorf returned home to Reading. He told the mayor, Phoebe Cusden, about what he'd seen, and she decided she had to see it for herself. Phoebe spoke to the BBC in 1981.
Oh, it was a devastation beyond description. People were living in bunkers and air raid shelters and cellars.
And what sort of state were the children in Dusseldorf?
Well, they were skeletons, half-starved, ragged, dreadful.
Phoebe was a Quaker and a pacifist. She hated seeing suffering caused by war and felt she had to help. She invited 6 children from Dusseldorf to come to Reading. The town had itself been bombed, food was still being rationed, and some people didn't agree with the mayor's invitation.
Some of them wrote letters to the paper and told them to let the Germans chew in their own juice. But mostly people, they just were wonderfully generous.
Phoebe put an advert in that same local newspaper, and June, who just started secondary school, saw it.
They were looking for somebody who would have a child for 3 months. And so I thought, well, that'd be interesting. So I said to Mother, can we have one? And so she said, ask your father. And Father said, I don't see why not. So I was on the phone straight away to Mrs. Cusden.
You phoned her yourself?
I phoned Mrs. Cusden, yes. And says, my mum says I can have a German child. So Phoebe then said, well, I'd better speak to your mother.
How did you first learn that you would be coming to England?
That was very funny.
It was a surprise. You had no idea?
No, I had no idea. I was sitting in my classroom and our headmistress came to the classroom and she said, Gretel, would you come to the office, please? And then she told us, you're going today to England. Just like that.
To this day, Gretel doesn't know for certain why she was chosen, but she quickly had to get ready to catch her train. Phoebe Cusden had spent several months arranging the children's journeys. They were only allowed to leave Germany with a visa, as they learned when their train reached the border on the 20th of April.
At the border to Belgium, we were called out, and there were soldiers, and they said, where's your passport? We didn't have passports. Where are your tickets? We didn't have tickets. The soldiers took us back in a jeep. My mother opened the door, and she said, oh, I knew it was a joke. Next day, I was in school again, of course. The secretary of the British headquarters came and she said, I made a mistake with the date. It's not the 20th, it's the 21st. So that day we had to leave.
My mother went to meet her at the railway station. I was at school, and when I came home from school, there was this little blonde child sitting in the corner, looking slightly bewildered, wearing a coat made from her father's army greatcoat and shoes that were falling off her feet because they had paper soles. I can remember the first thing she said to my mother, that somebody had given her £1.
I was hungry. I went to the bar on the boat and ordered a sandwich. Of course, that didn't cost the whole £1.
She gave my mother about 19 shillings back, an old money, and said,
here is my money. The rest I ate.
And we always teased her forevermore about the fact, no, you bought something to eat, Gretel, you didn't eat it.
That was the start of a friendship that's still going strong.
What was I, 10? 11?
No, no, no. I was 12. You must have been 13. You were nearly grown up. Yeah.
No. and had been fed on propaganda, and everything in Germany was terrible and dreadful and everybody was bad and all this sort of thing. And then Gretel appeared.
June, you gave me chocolate, didn't you?
I did. And yes. You hid it.
Yes, and I hid it.
And we shared, if you remember, quite a small bedroom. And I could hear this rustling, and we weren't supposed to eat chocolate after we'd brushed our teeth. Obviously, you'd hidden the chocolate. And I mean, I didn't understand why, but later I realised that, you know, there were problems at your end in Germany with having food sort of in the open, as it were. And I could hear this rustling going on, and you were eating your chocolate in bed.
There's a newspaper article in one of the local Reading papers which made the point that things were still tough in Britain.
Yeah.
I think it even uses the phrase, we should be looking after our own before we start helping Germans. Did you ever pick up on the fact that you were doing something that maybe not everyone was happy with at the time?
Oh, yes.
Yes, there was some opposition. And there was some people, why are you having a German child in your house? Just occasionally, I know my mother took Gretel somewhere and said, oh, stand in front of me, Gretel, because you won't see. I think it was, I don't know what it was, they were watching something. And turned to this lady and said, oh, this little girl is from Germany. And this woman said, oh, I'm not moving away for a German child or something.
I can understand that they didn't want us. I mean, we had been enemies. Germany had been a terrible enemy for Britain. But I never had the feeling that I was not welcome. There up
the bar. Phoebe Cusden died in 1981 at the age of 93. Reading and Dusseldorf have since become twin towns. The Reading-Dusseldorf Association is still arranging exchange visits, and June and Gretel are still great friends.
What would she make of us now, eh? You and I are older than Phoebe was when we met her.
Oh, my God, this is true.
They said with the twinning, I reckon you and I are the oldest twins in Europe, don't you?
The unifying story of June and Gretel, courtesy of Chris Browning and Witness at the BBC. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Life in Seoul isn't cheap, and many young Koreans feel that there's only one way to invest for their future. They're rolling the dice on cryptocurrencies.
Cryptocurrency, for now, it seems, is a ray of sunshine for me.
Banking on Bitcoin in South Korea and beyond. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Donald Trump made a lot of big promises in his run for the White House. Over his first year, he's delivered a tax cut, and he's sticking to his tough stand on immigration, apparently, although his big, beautiful wall does seem elusive, as do many other promises. But one big area in which he's mostly lived up to his rhetoric so far is climate change, energy, and the environment. Emily Holden reports on these issues for Politico. We asked her to walk us through how the president's campaign promises after his first year in office are holding up.
In terms of progress, you have to keep in mind that the promises that the administration made were to roll back regulations and try to boost fossil fuels. In most cases, the administration has taken at least the initial step to do those things.
That's including moves to open up more land to oil and gas drilling, boost the coal industry, approve the Keystone XL pipeline, and as Trump said during his campaign, quote, cancel the Paris Climate Agreement. But Holden says none of his actions are taking effect immediately.
Some of them are through the regulatory process, so they could take a long time, and they're definitely going to be caught up in court battles, too.
And I said he canceled, in quotation marks, the Paris Climate Agreement, but remind us of the kind of details in the cancellation.
Yes. So he said that he intends to withdraw the U.S. from the agreement unless the U.S. gets a better deal. But He has not exited yet. The administration actually has several years until they would be taking the official step to do that. And we still have had negotiators at meetings, including at the most recent UN climate meeting in Bonn in November.
So a lot of people were worried that Trump saying he'd pull out of the deal would actually unravel the whole deal. And it doesn't look like that's happening. But how much has the U.S. lost its leadership role? Like, what impact has that announcement had so far on U.S. standing internationally?
Well, I think that you hear people from other countries, especially climate-leading countries, talking about this as an embarrassment, the way that the president talks about his doubts about climate science. And that certainly has had an effect on the discussions. Countries that are taking climate action, I think, are very disappointed by these changes.
Now, President Trump and his EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt have made rolling back environmental regulations a priority. What, in your view, are some of the key regulations that have been rolled back, and how does their record actually compare to previous administrations?
So my coworker, Alex Guillen, put together the numbers on regulations from previous administrations and found that Administrator Scott Pruitt at EPA is rolling back more rules and proposing fewer new ones compared to previous administrators. I think the big two that you'll continue to hear a lot about are the Clean Power Plan and the Waters of the United States rule. So the Clean Power Plan was the Obama administration's climate standard, and the Trump administration has begun the process of repealing and replacing it with something much more narrow, is what it looks like they're going to do. And the Waters of the U.S. rule would have essentially clarified which waterways and wetlands could have protection under federal laws and regulations. And they are looking to most likely rewrite that in a way that will be much more narrow as well. But both of those will be in the courts for years to come.
Now, some scientists around the globe are worried that the Trump administration would censor climate science coming out of agencies like NASA or the EPA. But important climate change reports and data, they have been published in the last year. Does that mean that those fears have been overblown?
I think that scientists are still worried. The studies are still coming out from federal agencies, but we still have some political appointees who have not yet arrived at some of those agencies, and that could cause some changes. And while the science is still coming out, you also have to keep in mind that a lot of these federal government bodies have been stripping climate change information from their websites. They're changing those terms and removing and moving information, too.
So I got to say, you seem to take a fairly sober view of realistically what has happened under Trump on the environment. I contrast that with, you know, tweets from people in the environmental activist movement who remain alarmed by Trump for the rest of his term. Are they over-anxious?
I would say that I don't think that the Trump administration has done much to appease environmental advocates. I think that everything that they said that they would do, they're very actively and aggressively pursuing in terms of rolling back regulations. And we're still waiting to see the direct impact of some of those, and other of those worries that they have are more about inaction, things about environmental enforcement. And so you have to think about not just what the administration is actively undoing and proposing, but things that they might not be doing anymore as well.
Politico's Emily Holden speaking with us from Washington on the first year of Trump's environmental policies. Emily, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And speaking of a livable planet, come back next week for our series on kids and climate change. We're looking at what happens to kids in communities hard hit by changing conditions and more extreme weather. Kids like Levi Draheim, who lives on a barrier island on the coast of Florida.
There's like these maps and stuff like that, and it shows that this whole entire street will be completely underwater. We're 0 feet above sea level. So even if the polar ice caps melt a little bit, it'll go into the ocean, which is going to go into the Indian River Lagoon, which is going to flood our home.
Levi's not fazed, though. He's already fighting climate change every way he knows how. And in the Galapagos Islands, kids are fighting, too, trying to protect some pretty magnificent creatures from extinction.
Have you ever heard a giant land tortoise breathe?
Reporter Tipa Fernandez there in the Galapagos, tracking giant land tortoises with teenagers. Come back next week for her series on kids and climate change. Okay, let's talk cryptocurrency for a moment. If you follow Bitcoin, you know that it's taken a big plunge recently. After peaking about a month ago, Bitcoin has fallen by 50%. That's got a lot of investors freaking out. But let's be clear. If you bought one Bitcoin about 5 years ago at $13, you're not freaking out. You're sitting on well over 10 grand. not a bad return. But market analysts have warned for a while that cryptocurrencies are experiencing a bubble heading toward an inevitable burst. Hard to know really what's next for this virtual money, but we do know that the plummeting value has not deterred people around the world from investing for a whole lot of different reasons. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou has been speaking with one of them, and she joins me in the studio. So who are we going to hear from, Lydia?
So we'll be hearing from Jiwon Park. She is a young writer in Seoul, South Korea. Jiwon has been out of school for just about a year and a half. She managed to save up about $5,000, and recently she decided to invest a little more than half of that in Ether and Ripple. Those are two cryptocurrencies.
Ether and Ripple. So in South Korea, how big are cryptocurrencies generally?
They're big. So South Korea is the world's third largest market when we're talking about Bitcoin trading. But when you talk about other cryptocurrencies like Ether, for example, South Korea is the largest market. And a lot of the people investing in cryptocurrencies in South Korea, actually more than half of them, are believed to be in their 20s and 30s.
So what's driving this popularity of cryptocurrencies among the younger generation?
Well, that's why I called Jiwon Park. She wrote a piece recently for the magazine where she works. It's titled, I'm a 24-year-old South Korean and my hopes are in cryptocurrency.
I think to talk about South Koreans' interest in cryptocurrency, we first need to address our economic situation, especially for young adults. So almost one out of 10 young adults in South Korea are jobless. And then with our stagnant growth and current salary, it's just not enough to sustain our lives here. And I think that's why a lot of young adults are getting into cryptocurrency trading.
Yeah, and in your piece, you write, quote, people in their 20s and 30s account for more than half of all cryptocurrency investors in South Korea. I'm one of them, and I made my choice because my future in South Korea seemed so bleak. Can you explain that a little bit? Because you got a college education, you now have a job. Why do you feel that your future is so bleak?
Well, it's just so bleak in terms of the salary I'm getting. And then I was thinking about grad school. I was thinking about, you know, potentially getting a house, and that's possible only through a loan. But now with cryptocurrency, I could potentially, you know, make some money for myself to further my education and potentially, you know, if I get lucky to get a house. So a cryptocurrency for now, as it seems, is a ray of sunshine for me.
But some would say it's really risky business. I mean, there's the volatility of the market. And then specifically in South Korea, there's been talk of officials regulating, even shutting down cryptocurrency exchanges. Does that make you nervous? I mean, does it scare you?
It does scare a lot of young adults, including myself, because we've, you know, put our savings into the market. For now, I'm just hoping for the best. I just hope they don't shut it down.
I'm wondering how older South Koreans are looking at this. What have you heard from your parents, your grandparents, older people in your life about how they see this?
I think older adults, they are puzzled by this trend. And one of my senior colleagues, he said, I am being greedy. Because some of the traditional view in Korea is they think that millennials are being greedy and we just want to make a fast, quick cash. I don't think that's the case. I just think that traditional way of accumulating wealth in Korea just takes such a long time. Cryptocurrency is helping young adults to potentially achieve what they want to do in life.
Back in our studios here in Boston with the World's Lydia Emanuelidou. You know, I was just listening to another report, Lydia, by our colleagues at the BBC about how millennials around the world, not just South Korea, are seeing virtual currencies as a way to make money.
Well, I think at the beginning, when we first started hearing about cryptocurrencies, a lot of people were really excited about the anonymity, the practical use of virtual currencies. But I think it's now evolved into a way, as we heard from Jiwon, to make money.
The World's Lydia Emanuelidou, thanks very much for this.
Thank you.
Then there are the people with lots of money who are also interested in the cryptocurrency market. In fact, in St. Moritz, Switzerland, where the rich go to ski and play, there's been a whole conference on cryptocurrencies going on. Brenna Hughes-Nagaiwi is a reporter for Reuters in Switzerland. A lot of times we hear about Bitcoin as a way for the average person to potentially make a lot of money. So why are billionaires and venture capitalists, people who already have a lot of money, why are they interested in cryptocurrencies?
So one thing I think we have to look at, of course, is the massive amount of speculation and astronomical rise that was recorded in 2017. But what I was hearing from a lot of the venture capitalists who were present was also that they see a lot of talent going into the space, and they see this as a funding model that's going to be gaining prominence, maybe becoming the most prominent sort of model in the future. And they're looking for a way to maintain relevance in this new space and get ahead of the game a little bit.
So this conference is being held in St. Moritz. Tell us about this location. Why do you think it was chosen?
Well, St. Moritz, you know, it's kind of touted as the birthplace of the winter ski resort. It's a very glamorous location. The conference was hosted in a beautiful 5-star hotel called the Suvretta House, where a number of royals and movie stars and the like are said to have stayed in the past. And so for a conference that was looking to bring together entrepreneurs in the cryptocurrency space and the world's wealthy, this was kind of a setting that adds a certain prestige to that endeavor.
And did they get those guests? Like, who attended this conference? Am I wrongly assuming that it was only the very wealthy?
So it was a mix of people, a lot of familiar faces from the cryptocurrency space, entrepreneurs, techies, but then, of course, also anyone with, you know, enough money to spend on the 3,700 euro ticket price. We were told that there was over a dozen billionaires there.
What were some of the main takeaways from this conference?
Some of the main takeaways for me is that it's ultimately still a very risky, risky space. And that's, you know, something that we've seen this week with the volatility in Bitcoin, which is ultimately driven by worries about the regulatory future of cryptocurrencies. But it's also a space that, you know, is attracting mainstream attention in this big way. And one of the venture capitalists I spoke to mentioned he's been invested in things like the early expansion of the internet, autonomous cars, social media. And these are all technologies that took quite a bit of time to really catch on. And when you're looking at cryptocurrencies, the expansion has been huge and extremely fast.
But as you say, people who invest in cryptocurrencies are exposing themselves to a lot of risk. I mean, how concerned were people at the conference that Bitcoin recently tanked in value?
You know, what's funny is that that topic didn't really come up very much. You would have thought it was something that would be on people's minds a little bit more. But I think a lot of people in the space have gotten used to the volatility. They see it as something characteristic of this early stage, and they all seem pretty optimistic about the future.
So if venture capitalists and entrepreneurs are interested in cryptocurrency as another avenue for funding, would you say it is becoming more mainstream?
I would definitely say it's becoming more mainstream. But I think regulation and also security are major concerns, and the space is moving more quickly than the entire scaffolding is being set up. I think regulators are going to have a big say in where it goes from here.
Brenna Hughes-Nagaiwi with Reuters, speaking with us from Zurich, Switzerland. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Marco. Pleasure.
Saudi Arabia is in the midst of huge changes. Over the past year, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has been consolidating his power, even if that means locking up some of his own relatives. He's also pursuing a new aggressive foreign policy, including a devastating intervention in neighboring Yemen. But he's also pushing back some of the country's conservative social policies. So I'm really curious to get the first impressions of the kingdom from an outsider.
That is an easy, easy answer. It's the sheer number of American food chains there are here. There are loads and loads of them. I thought Britain and the US had a great relationship. But if we're to judge it on the number of franchises they have, then Saudi Arabia is far ahead. There are franchises I've never seen before that I've just heard of. Red Lobster and steakhouses that I've never heard of. There's just tons and tons of American chains here.
That's the World's Rich Hall in Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia. Now, foreign journalists are not routinely allowed in, but we're fortunate to have Rich there this week. So a rare set of eyes and ears in the kingdom. Let's start with how you actually got there, Rich.
Yeah, it's a bit of a strange one. Saudi Arabia isn't very friendly to foreign journalists. It's very, very hard to get a visa here. In fact, its own journalists aren't treated very well at all. They're regularly locked up for writing things that are out of the government line. But I managed to get a visa through an alternate route almost. We were invited to cover a camel festival near the capital, Riyadh. It's a camel cultural festival, kind of a heritage festival about camels. There's a camel beauty contest. You'll hear more about that on the world in the coming days, I think, or weeks. We're doing a story about that. But yeah, so you have to be kind of creative to get a visa if you're a journalist to come to Saudi Arabia. So we got the visa for the camel festival, and they didn't impose any restrictions on us in terms of what we could report. So I've been here meeting activists and meeting ordinary people, Saudis, and talking to them about what's going on in Saudi Arabia at the moment.
So, I mean, a camel festival, it seems innocent enough, but I mean, why do you think they let you come in?
Well, I think at the moment, Saudi Arabia is going through a lot of changes. They have realized that they can't stay closed off forever. Economically and politically, they're opening up. There are some major changes taking place at the moment for women in the workforce. They're being allowed to drive this year. And among the people as well, there's just a really strong desire to open up to the world. They have Twitter. Twitter is huge in Saudi Arabia. I didn't realize it was so big before I came. But they want to open up to the world, and I think the Saudi royal family has realized that. And speaking of opening up to the world, I actually bumped into four Americans today at this camel festival. While I'm here, I'm going to be talking to lots of Saudis, but I just thought it'd be interesting to talk to these guys about their impressions of Saudi Arabia, because they've actually been here a while, and they've been here before, I found out.
We're part of a medical team from Cleveland, Ohio, from the Cleveland Clinic. I'm a physician, Max a physician, Jeremy's a PA, and Bill's a nurse.
So the next voice you're going to hear is Jeremy Melanthin. He's 43 years old, and he's been here for 2 years. And I asked him if things had changed since he first arrived 2 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. In the beginning, even the religious police would stop us during prayer, and you couldn't look in a shop. And now you don't see that anymore. In fact, you see Saudis walking around the malls, and that's a big deal. Also, women no longer have to cover their head completely. They can have some hair exposed. So it's different. And they get to start driving this year.
So as I talked to them some more, I realized that three of the four had been here before. They're actually veterans of the first Gulf War, and they were here in 1990. So I asked them, of course, what was different between then and now? And this is what Mark Eastie said to me.
I would say it was different. Like Jeremy said, the religious police were very prolific at that time. And actually, if you went to a shopping mall or something like that, they were literally patrolling. You know, in case you were going to a restaurant in prayer and all. Obviously, that's not that way now. You know, certainly it's much more, you know, westernized now.
And also Bill Hurley from near Seattle in Washington, he's also a veteran. He was also here in 1919. Here's what he said it changed.
The thing that I've noticed the most since I came back, and especially in the last year, is, again, the relaxation on the oppression of women. Women are being permitted into areas like this festival, into sporting events, into cars in ways that they weren't before, and even a year ago when I came here, ways that I didn't see then. So it's been very enlightening for me to see, and it's been very enjoyable because, like the rest of these guys, I like the Saudi people. That's one of the reasons that I'm here, and I like learning about their culture and their perspective on what's happening on the planet compared to ours. And it's very nice to see that sort of restricted area of their culture growing very quickly and developing.
So, Rich, some progress for women, but, you know, the rejoinder I hear from many Saudis, especially Saudi women, is that there is still a long way to go, right?
Exactly. There's been slow progress, but Saudi Arabia isn't going to change overnight. It's still one of the worst places in the world for women, without a doubt. We still have the male guardianship system here, where every woman must have a male guardian, could be their father, their brother, husband, or even a son, who has the authority to make loads of critical decisions on her behalf. It could be anything from getting a passport, studying abroad. That's just one of the many challenges women face here. There has been some changes, but there's still a long way to go.
The World's Rich Hall in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Thanks for telling us about what you're seeing there, Rich.
Thanks, Marco.
Rich is taking over the world's Instagram account while he's in Saudi Arabia. Head over to @theworld on Instagram to see him at the Camel Festival and more posts from the kingdom. Meantime, on the western edge of the Arab world, in Algeria, the band Imarhan kicks out their own distinctive style of desert rock. Imarhan joins a growing list of Tuareg musicians from North and West Africa. They're young, and these guys are updating the desert sound for a new generation. Imarhan's new album drops next month, but this is the lead single, Azaman, already out for your listening pleasure. That's where we leave things today. I'm Marco Werman, coming to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. Y'all have a great weekend.
Public Radio International.